one of the first symptoms that most sickle cell patients demonstrate at a few months old, your baby is going through pain that could be as intense as childbirth. What? That doesn't even make any sense.
I beg your pardon. Hello, bestie. It's your favorite caffeinated, medicated, and never hydrated nurse, Nurse John. And welcome back to your favorite therapy podcast, I Beg Your Pardon. And for today, bestie, we have a special guest. But before I introduce my special guest to you, I just want to say that if you're listening to this right now, do me a huge favor and make sure that you download this new episode and the other episodes, and make sure you follow our podcast in Apple and Spotify and turn on notification, and make sure that you share it and tag me on Instagram so that I can repost anything that you put out in your story. So how are you doing today, bestie? I miss you all so much. I am so happy to be back here. I hope you're doing well. I hope life is going the way you want it. And remember, if it's not, that is totally fine, because every single day is another day for you to make a new beginnings, new start. And again, never ever compare your path or your journey to somebody else, because bestie, you have your own shining moment. And everyone has their own shining moment. And even though you're not there yet, keep working on it, keep believing in yourself, and keep manifesting it. The manifestation, the stronger it is, the more it comes to you. And less of the negative self-talk, less of the negative seeing things the way it shouldn't be, and less stressing of things that's not there yet. You focus on the present, not the past, not the future, where you are right now, because that's your gift, the present. Beautiful. Actually, I have a very special guest. She was once my patient. Yes, that's right. When I was nursing in bedside. And now she is sitting with me here in my podcast studio. I am so lucky that she accepted my invitation for her to come to my studio and have this very special episode. And she is a sickle cell anemia warrior. Anyways, you guys, so presenting to you guys is Keely, a sickle cell anemia warrior, who will be giving us an introduction and story of her life dealing with and fighting through her invisible illness, sickle cell anemia. Keely, you can take up the mic.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you for accepting my invitation. And I know, like I was telling you, wait, isn't this a violation? But I was like, you know what? I'm not working bedside. And listen, the only way I found out about you is you commented in one of my videos.
Yeah.
It was, I think, me dancing into a Jamaican song.
Yeah. So many people like the comments.
I think it's the fact that you told them that we crossed paths together in the hospital.
Yeah. I remember when I had actually met you and I'm just like, hold on, wait. And I felt like I had the Dazzle Raven moment. I'm like, hold on. I know his face from somewhere. I'm like,
I remember that. Because I think it was a night shift.
Yes.
It was a night shift. Yes. It was like 10 or 11 mm-hmm. when I'm coming into your room. And I was like, hi, my name is John De La Cruz. I'm going to be your nurse for tonight. And you're like, I know you from somewhere.
Yeah.
And then I brought down my mask. You're like, wait, you're the TikTok guy, right?
I'm like, oh my gosh. I got to meet you in person.
Exactly. I mean, like, I was happy that you recognized me, because then I still always have this kind of like anxiety whenever I go to my patient's room,
mm-hmm.
because I would never know how they're going to be,
yeah.
like how they're going to react. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be nice? Are they going to be rude? Is it going to be a pleasant interaction?
Mm-hmm.
And then I come in, I saw you in pain. I was like, oh God. And listen, when I moved to the ER, that is the only time that I was really able to take care of someone who has sickle cell.
Sickle cell patient can be in any unit, but majority of the time, at least in my personal experience where I've been admitted, you know, post ER visit, I go to the internal med floor. I don't know, you can clarify this or put some light to it, but from what I hear, you don't really get a lot of literature anyways. When you're learning in nursing, it's like just like a little chapter, dedicate a couple minutes and then it's off to the next thing.
Right. We would learn about it, let's say two classes, but you never really dive deep into illnesses. And the only way that you're actually able to like study it is when you have that patient who's suffering from that specific illness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have it often, it would never stick in your brain.
Yeah. And I know when I was a child, of course, nobody likes going to the emergency.
No.
But I used to hate it with a passion. I used to be a difficult patient to deal with. Like, my parents were always really sweet. And I think there's a lot of compassion that goes when you're in pediatric, of course.
Right, of course.
But when you're transitioned from pediatric to adult, there's no, like, hand-holding or...
Right, they expect you to adult.
Yeah, like overnight.
Like, if you turn from 17 to 18, you should know your stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, but some people take time to really mature and really get, you know, to things. But honestly, like, what I realize is when you have an illness, if it started from the young age, you start maturing. You start knowing your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I have had patients that are super young. They know more stuff about their illness more than I do.
Yeah.
And they would be, like, 12. I was like, girl, how do you know all of this? Like, HB1, AC, like, mutation. I was like, wait a minute.
If I had the technology that we have today when I was, like, 10. But I'm well-versed. And I can even educate some residents or some nurses that come into my room and ask me questions, or they ask me, what's your standard of care? What do you do? I'm like, well, so this is my typical procedure. And
that's perfect. Well, since you're there already, can you give us, because I would give the introduction, but my introduction of sickle cell anemia is coming from Google, because Google is my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's very textbook and whatnot.
Yeah.
But for people who don't know what sickle cell anemia is, can you give us an introduction? What is sickle cell anemia?
Okay, so sickle cell anemia is an inherited blood disease. You're born with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blood cell mutation. So you have to have this trait coming from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, both of my parents, my mother and my father, they have sickle cell trait, which is, if you want to say, sort of a benign version of sickle cell.
Right, because there's types of sickle cell anemia. There's the worse, there's the mid, and there's the thalassemia.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So you're right. So those are full-blown diseases. Aside from that, there's sickle cell trait. Sickle cell trait is, you know, hemoglobin AS.
Right.
And that means that they have some traces of sickled blood. So what that means is, with every pregnancy, if two parents have the sickle cell trait, with every pregnancy, there's a 25% chance that that child can get the disease. There's a 50% chance that child can get the trait. And there's the last remaining 25% chance that the child will come out with no disease. So in my case, I have multiple siblings. I'm the only one with the disease. I have some with the trait, some without. And I'm the only one with the disease in my immediate family.
Okay. And if you don't mind me asking, how many are you guys?
Five.
Oh my God. And where are you in the five?
I'm right in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're literally the star.
Basically.
You're the star of the five.
Exactly.
Again, like, this is new for me, and it's nice to know it, but at the same time, like, I feel bad, because then if you're telling me that out of five kids, you're the only one who's have it or who's suffering from it.
Yeah.
Then have you ever think about it, like, why me of all of us five?
Of course. I mean, I feel like now that I'm an adult, I've come to terms with it. I take me as I am. But when I was a child, I battled with it a lot. I mean, there's a lot of internal struggle, you know. So if I go back to the explanation, your red blood cell, everybody knows that they're supposed to be round. They carry oxygen to your organs, to your every part of your body, anywhere you have a blood vessel, to your bones. And one of my deficiencies is the fact that my bone marrow does produce enough blood. But amongst that, there's a good percentage, let's say, for example purposes, 50% of those red blood cells will lose oxygen within 10 to 20 days.
Oh my God.
Versus the regular healthy blood cell loses oxygen within 120 days. So imagine how rapidly
it's just
losing blood. And then when they when the oxygen decreases from that sickled cell, it starts to change its shape. So instead of being a nice flexible,
round, circle, yeah. oblong-ish.
Exactly. It turns into a crescent, turns into a straight bar.
Yeah, a half moon, right?
Exactly.
Because that's how we learn in school.
Exactly. So that's where it gets its name, sickled self, from being a sickled shape. So it goes from an O to something more like this or straight. And then those affected red blood cells, infected ones, if you want to say sick red blood cells, they are no longer round. They're no longer flexible. They're no longer how can you say, smooth. They become rigid. And then they get clogged in your...
in the circulation.
Yeah, so in your veins, everywhere. So wherever it's affected... That's the organ that's affected. That's the tissue that's affected. That's the bone that's affected. That's the pain. That's the one symptom that all sickle cell patients who have the disease kind of have in common. Some have sickle cell crises, is what we refer to it as, but it's basically a flare up. An intense pain crisis is what we call a flare up.
And that is depending on where the clog of red blood cells is.
Yeah.
So it could be in your ribs, it could be in your shoulder, it could be in your knees.
It can be
anywhere.
Exactly. In my experience, the majority of the time, my sickle cell crises are usually in my lower back or my joints. But that doesn't mean I never had a sickle cell crisis in my leg or my arm, you know? And if you can imagine, your blood supplies your whole body. So you can have complications, a wide range of complications from organ failure, from arthritis, from strokes, from brain infarcts, from seizures, like the list, even skin problems. Ulcers is really common.
Right.
It really depends. So I've had my number of side effects from sickle cell too, but that's basically the short version of it. It's a red blood cell disorder that's inherited from your parents, and it causes... blockages in your veins that then affect that area.
Right. And I'm not going to act stupid or anything, but I'm going to act as if I don't know the disease. Because, again, you see sickle cell most to Black people.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it more common to Black people compared to any other races?
The history of it is it was a normal human mutation that happened in the red blood cell to fight malaria. And malaria is usually in Africa. So me or Black people are. It originated in areas around the Nile River, and then it spread from there. So what happened is people would have regular 120-day living red blood cells, and then a few of those red blood cells would mutate, and that is what we call sickle cell trait. So that's what my parents have. So they have a benign state of the disease, just putting it in air quotes because it's not benign, but a less effective one. You have a few of them in your blood cells, but you live a fairly normal life. Malaria needs a good blood host. So if some of your blood cells are dying off, it doesn't get to multiply as quickly, and you build up some sort of resistance. However, the more people started having sickle cell traits, they started having children, and then their children had a 25% of having the disease. And fast forward, here we are today with many, many people in African descent regions around the world that are the primary patients for sickle cell disease.
And I heard it's how your body evolves within the environment that you live in.
Yeah.
Just like in Asia, it's more common for Asian people to have hypertension or hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is very common to Asian people.
Mm.
Again, don't quote me a lot for those
things.
Either, again, I'm not reading through Wikipedia here or Google, but like, don't quote me. And again, people who have it, mostly mothers, pass it through their newborn.
Mm.
And then it becomes a thing. And now mostly Asian people have hepatitis B.
See, I didn't know that. But it's environmental. That's how it's originated. And now it's just become like a common within a certain region. So that's how sickle cell originated. But yes, it does it many, many Black people. But as you said, South American as well. But as the world is modernizing, you're seeing it in almost anyone now.
Right.
Right.
So. I mean, like, also people migrate in different places and whatnot.
Exactly.
And, you know, people marry different, like, races, and it just gets passed along generation, and it becomes, like, a whole thing instead of, like, a very specific, like,
exactly. So continent. That's how, even though both of my parents, yes, they're from the same country and everything, but they didn't know they had sickle cell. They had no idea until they had me, and I was diagnosed, I think, at 4 months. I went to the ER because one of the first symptoms that people display when they have sickle cell, it's called hand-foot syndrome. So as a child, as a baby, your hands will swell, your feet will swell because you're having a sickle cell crisis, but your body's so small. So it's kind of swells up and you're in excruciating pain as a child. You can't communicate that anyway except to cry.
Yeah.
So then they brought me to the ER. They did some testing, and then it came back that I had sickle cell disease. At the time, they did not test for that in newborns, but it's been, I think this year actually is the 10th year anniversary in Quebec that they screen for sickle cell disease now.
Oh my God, that is so, that's revolutionary.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah.
It helps a lot of like parents and kids who doesn't know that they might have it or carry it, so that, you know, when they grow up and decided to get married and whatnot, they're more aware of like, hey, I have this trait, or there's a possibility that one of our kids could have it.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of just like unknowingly having a kid and
Can you imagine?
What is wrong with my baby?
My mom had me and she had no clue that, you know, her child would come up with such a debilitating, invisible disease. So me and my family, we just learned along the way. Even though it doesn't affect your day to day, it's still something that you carry, that you, that if you get with someone, a partner that has a sickle cell trait, you could potentially pass it down to your kid. So don't forget. And there are symptoms that they are still predisposed to, although they don't have a full blown disease, they are predisposed to it too.
Right.
It's very unheard of someone with sickle cell trait having a crisis, but it actually happened to one of my siblings.
And, oh my God.
And he was completely unaware what it felt like. He was like, is this what you go through all the time?
I'm like, he must have been like,
yeah, he's like, this is crazy.
I should be more nice to her.
Because
type of thing.
The pain is indescribable.
Right. So I asked people from Instagram if you have anything, like as a healthcare worker or as a general public, what is something you would want to ask someone who has sickle cell anemia?
Okay.
And one of their questions is like, how does the pain feels like for you? POV.
Okay. So to provide some clarity, there is an index scale that's very accessible to anybody out there. It's hard to find. I remember I did a lot of like Google research and I only found one on Google. I'm sure it exists other places. I don't know.
Right.
But there's an index scale that kind of parallels pain on a chart.
Yeah.
And we all know childbirth to be high up there, assisted childbirth, breaking a leg or something like that.
Right.
You know, perhaps cancer treatment. So it's all on this scale. Every sickle cell pain crisis is not the same severity, of course.
Yeah.
But it has been evaluated to potentially be as painful as assisted childbirth, which is very painful.
Painful.
Can you imagine? One of the first symptoms that most sickle cell patients demonstrate is hand-foot syndrome at a few months old. Your baby is going through pain that could be as intense as childbirth. What? That doesn't even make any sense.
Doesn't make sense.
So imagine presenting yourself. Usually, if I go to the ER, it's because I've tried all my options already at home. I'm not going to just be like, oh, I'm feeling a little pain. Okay, let me go straight to the ER right away. No. It's not a pleasant thing. Most people go to the ER, and from my experiences, my family, my friends, they don't pack a bag. They think they're just going to go with the clothes on their back, and they're expecting to be treated and let go by the end of the night, or maybe at most spend a day.
Right.
Me, I know if I'm going to the ER, there's a potential that I'm staying the whole night. I might be there for a week.
And sorry for cutting you off, but that's when you were, I guess, versed with your disease, like with your illness.
Actually, I feel like my upbringing had a lot to do with it because my mom kind of instilled in me and she trained me that way. But before, when I used to get sick and go to the ER, we used to wait until that moment. Like, okay, we know we're going to have to take a trip to the hospital. Let's pack right away. And I realize now that I'm an adult and I'm independent, I live on my own, I can't wait until I'm bent over in pain. So I kind of have, you know how people who are pregnant, they have like a hospital bag ready to go?
Right, the hospital bags and stuff.
I have it ready to go.
Amen.
At any time. So,
amen. So do you most of the time go there alone or with someone?
Okay. I prefer going with someone.
Of course.
But I understand that being someone with a chronic illness, I visit the ER way more than the average person.
Right.
So it's inconvenient to always wait for someone to be available or to even put that burden on them to come with me to the ER every time. Because am I really going to make this person, whoever I want to go to the hospital with, have them sit down with me in the ER for hours and wait and this and look for parking? And so nowadays I'll just go when I need to and I'll just keep them updated and I'll say, okay, I'm in this room now, or I'm admitted, or here, you can come and join me. But for the most part, I might ask to be dropped. But there's been times where I've driven myself to the hospital.
Oh my God. Girl, I could not imagine. I mean, like, just like telling you, like when I'm in pain, I would literally tell anybody, like I could have anything in the world but pain. Because pain is the worst thing you could ever have. Mm-hmm. Like I have had like patient who had cancer and they're like, I don't care if I have a tumor, as long as it's not painful, I can live with it. But if I have pain, it's like,
it's debilitating.
It's like you don't want to talk to anybody. You cannot talk to anybody. You cannot express yourself. You're angry. You're frustrated. It's everything.
Yes. So going back to your question, okay. I want to give a little story time.
Cool. Love it. I love story time. Let's hit up a story time.
So there was one time that I was at a previous job. And I decided I'm trying to live a healthy life. I'm going to go to the gym. Usually I go to the gym after work. But this day I decided to go to the gym before work. I don't know what.
Girl, I did that too. Listen, before you continue, I have done the same thing where I was like, you know what? Let me just be fit before I go to work. And girl, trust me, for 12 hours, I was like pulling myself to do things because my whole body just aches.
Okay.
And imagine. Anyways, go continue.
Okay, so what you said, your whole body was aching. I went into a full-on crisis. Okay, so I was at the gym, and as I was working out, towards the end of the whole workout, I was fine. Towards the end of the workout, I could feel the onset of pain. So I'm going to give you like a point of view, like you said.
A POV, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm at the gym and I'm probably like doing cardio now. I'm like on the treadmill or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to feel pain in my lower back. That's like my trigger point. Joints and lower back is usually where I get most of my pain.
Right.
And I feel it onset. At first, I'm like, okay, this is just soreness. It's fine. Then I'm feeling it come in a little bit more. And I'm just like, okay. And I have to breathe. I'm like, okay, you know what? Let's get off the treadmill. Let's just do something a little easy. Let's just stretch.
Maybe this is not for us.
Exactly.
Right now.
I'm like, let's just stretch. And I'm stretching and the pain is moving from one part of the body to another and it's getting more and more intense. As the minutes go by. So for me, think about like if you stubbed your toe. When you stub your toe, you feel the throbbing sensation.
I'm angry.
Exactly. So with every heartbeat that I have, I'm feeling the pain get intense in my back. So now it's spreading from my back to my entire torso. So it's my lower back as well as like my rib cage. And with every breath, it's like the pain is getting worse.
You have to
worse.
Use muscle.
It's getting worse.
I know.
It's getting worse. It's getting worse. And this is what it feels like. And it's just getting worse and worse. And I can feel the blockage where the sickling is what we refer to it as. Where it's
sickling.
The blockage is happening. I can feel the pain of that getting worse. And it feels like shards of glass just trying to get through your veins.
Oh.
And it's just really intense. So I had to talk. I had to meditate and talk myself through this. I said, okay. You decided to go to the gym before work. You have things to do, okay?
Now you're putting the pressure on yourself.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay. So what I do, I'm literally talking to myself. I think I have a post on this online. Okay, I'm talking to myself. I'm like, okay, Akilia, that's my actual name.
Cute. It's so unique.
Yeah. So Akili is what everyone calls me, my friends, my family. It's very familiar. So I'm like, okay, you can do this. Let's forget the workout today. You have things to do. So I get off the treadmill. I stop stretching, and then I'm walking towards the, what do you call it, vestiaire in English?
The locker. Yeah, the locker. Yeah,
Montreal
sorry.
Montreal problems.
Because we're bilingual. we speak more than just English.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So, I go to the locker room and I'm like putting on my coat. I'm like, okay. I'm talking to myself internally. I'm like, okay, take off your gym shoes. Okay, breathe. Okay, gym shoes are off. Okay, put on your boots because it's like winter.
This is literally me on my anxiety attacks.
Yeah.
I'm just like, John, get it together.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm having a sickle cell crisis and a whole on anxiety attack at the same time, because I'm like, I'm out in public, I'm by myself, I'm not home. Okay, I need to get through it. So I'm like, okay, put on your boots. Then I'm like, okay, breathe, sit down. Then I'm like, okay, get your coat, don't forget your phone. Okay, sit down. Then I'm like, okay, where's the car keys? Where are the car keys? Turn on the car, start the car. Then I'm like, okay, because the heat will help me. So I'm like, I need the car to be hot. It's winter. I can't go into the cold car. The car needs to be
right
hot. When
because
I go
one
there.
Of the worst thing that triggers it is cold, right?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So overexertion, cold, some people is alcohol, some people is high altitudes as well.
Right.
These are like the golden triggers, but there's always other things that can trigger.
Right. Because I think those triggers are causing you to lose oxygen, which you don't already have completely or enough.
There you go. Yeah. So that's what it is. So I was coming out of the gym and I was like, okay, the car has to be hot. So I walked to the car, and then I completely forgot that day that I was supposed to train someone new.
Oh my God.
So I had to go to the office, which wasn't far from the gym, thankfully. I had to go to the office and drop off all of like the training material that I had prepared for this new employee. So I went to the office and I'm just like, okay, you can drive. It's like a 10-minute drive, you can do it. And I'm driving and I'm just like, oh, I'm like every couple of seconds I'm just like cringing and bent over in pain.
Oh,
and
my
I get
God.
To the office and I like hobble out of the car and I make it to the office and I'm like, hi, my name is such and such, nice to meet you, I'm gonna go to the hospital. He's like, are you okay? I'm like, I don't feel good, one of my colleagues is gonna come and, you know, she's gonna take over. So she, thankfully, Angel, she was able to come and take over the training. And then I left and I told my manager, I'm like, I am going to the ER right now, I will keep you updated. And I just left. He had no idea what was going on, anything. I'm like, I'm not in a position to explain
anything.
Yeah.
I just need to be in the ER.
Yeah. And that was my first experience. After that, I got in the car and I called my partner at the time. I called my parents and I told them, I am in a severe, like severe crisis right now. It came on suddenly. In my personal experience, prior to that, I had never in my life gone to the hospital unexpectedly. I had always buried it at home and kind of like monitored it a little bit, tried to treat myself, if you want to say, at home before going to the hospital. But I had no choice at this point. It came on so suddenly. It was so strong. I was in so much pain. I had to drive. And while I was driving, it was like a 20-minute drive to the hospital. So I was just like, okay. I was crying. I was breathing. It's like I was...
I don't even know how you drive to the hospital, because I would be just like pissed with my whole family. Pick me up right now. Rush in because I need help.
Yeah, but then if I had to wait for them, I would have to wait even longer in an uncomfortable environment. Like at work, as crazy as it sounds, I would be more comfortable in my car than I would have been sitting in that office waiting for them.
Right. So honestly, my car is my comfort.
There you go.
I cry there. I scream. I laugh. I sing. I do everything in my car.
Exactly.
I was like, I keep telling people, I was like, if my car can talk, it's going to
all
need
your business.
It's going to need therapy. of all the things that it heard, it would be like,
this guy's crazy.
this guy needs help. He needs help right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's crazy. Well, since you're talking about work, so my question to you is, so are you employed right now? Are you working right now?
Yes.
So if you're employed right now and you're working right now, do you disclose your illness to your work? Because again, my question to this is that, what if, let's say, it's a really busy day, and then you have a flare up, and you just gone because you have no time to just like tell people.
Yeah.
Because there are times that I just disappear because, let's say, I'm not feeling good. Things are not right. I don't have time to tell people my business.
Yeah, give them the courtesy and advance notice.
Exactly. So what do you do in that case? Because then you go to interviews, you get these things, and they're going to ask you, so is there anything else you want to tell us?
Yeah. So that's, I've had every experience you can think of with employers. All of them, anything you can name of. Somebody accepting you, you fully disclosing from the beginning, you withholding and only telling them afterwards, presenting a medical note, being let go, having understanding bosses. I've experienced everything. My family thinks I'm crazy because I always look for them. Not always, but I tend to get like different job opportunities one after another. So
that's amazing.
Thankfully, I've been blessed that way. But it hasn't been easy to always keep them. That is the problem. I did some research online about what kind of rights do I have, you know, as somebody with an illness who is employed in corporate Canada. I was going to say corporate America, whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And what are some procedures that I can do? So I came up with a process that works for me, but I don't know if that's applicable for everybody. So I asked for their opinions. So in my opinion, what did not work for me in the past was not disclosing my disability, but I do it in these stages. So I'll have the interview. I'll keep that private. I don't say anything. Even sometimes in job questionnaires, when they'll ask you the disability waiver, if you want to disclose if you're somebody who's disabled.
Right.
I typically do not fill that out. I'll say like, does not wish to answer, unless I've gotten a job offer or I'm applying to a job through an agency. Like if the agency wants to disclose that, then cool, that's fine, because they're probably specifically looking for jobs that have a disability quota.
Right.
So just like how you can make race quota work for you or whatever quota, just make the quotas work for you. There's a time and place to fight every battle. If they have a disability quota, just it's a job reserved for somebody with an illness. So why not take it? There's more reassurance for you.
Right.
But if it's just me applying directly by myself, most of the time I would not fill that out.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do the process. I'll do the telephone interview. I'll do the screening. I'll do the in-person interview. And I still won't say anything. When I get the job and I sign the contract, then I will disclose in writing. And what I do is I found a script online, like a template that I
do
use
this.
Now.
I do this. Yeah. I love scripts. I'm not that literate about like things. Like I have to say encyclopedia for words because I'm not going to sound professional in no way.
Exactly. So I looked at a script. I found a legal strip. It's like a little blurb, if you want to say. And I kind of just plug in the information for me. The whole point of this is they don't know about sickle cell. I had an experience where one of my employers, I had not disclosed to them my illness at all. And when I did get ill, I presented them with medical certificates. And then after I would give them medical certificates every now and then because I had like, let's say, doctor's appointments or I got sick in the hospital. I needed time off. And she's like, what is it? What do you have? And she kept on asking me all the time, what is your medical condition? What is it? What is
right.
it? Then finally, I was just like, okay, I have sickle cell anemia. She's like, what is that? Exactly. You don't know. So what is the point of me disclosing it to you? And it didn't change anything with how she treated me before or after. But she did see me as somebody who was now unreliable, who couldn't come into work all the time, who she couldn't count on. But I understand it from a business aspect. The exchange here is time for salary. If how do you expect me to pay you if your time that you owe me, let's say, is not accounted for? If a job hires you, it's because they need that body. They need the person. They need you to show up to work. They need the job to be done. And if you're somebody who's calling out sick and who takes extended long vacations, they're like, okay, well, they feel trapped because now they got to pay insurance. Now they got to find somebody else to replace you. And it's complicated for them, but they have a legal obligation. The reason why I don't tell them until afterwards, because one, what I mentioned before, I want you to evaluate me based on my skill and based on being a viable candidate. And if you think that I'm good for the job, then that's all that should matter. Then I usually ask for reasonable accommodation. I think that's the word legally. I don't remember. But reasonable accommodation. I don't ask for anything extravagant, and they're not obligated to actually accept anything. But if they do, then that usually shows how they're a little bit more compassionate. And I also ask questions in the interview process that will give me an understanding on how flexible they are. This is not just you're trying to hire me and you have all the benefit. No, no, no. There has to be a benefit for me too.
Amazing.
Which before I
did it has
not,
to be that way.
Yeah, before I did not think that way. I was just like, okay, they're a job. I should be grateful. No, if I'm going to work for you and you want to hire me as an employee, because I'm going to be spending so much time here.
So I better have a benefit.
Exactly. Is there any benefits? What kind of benefits? Is there a wellness program? Can I get a reimbursement for the gym, for the spa, for the this, for the that? I want to know everything.
Period. So, as you should.
Every job says they have amazing work culture. Okay.
Oh my God. That's always the case. Like, we're a family here. No, baby. This is not Fast and the Furious.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
This is not Vin Diesel.
So I really try to ask them, oh, you, what is your work culture? What do you guys do? Like, what do you guys encourage personal time? Do you encourage, what does this mean? Is work culture, oh, we're going to honor the staff by getting them pizza?
Right. Because, baby, if it's pizza over, like, $100 spa.
Exactly. There's a difference, right? There's a balance. So I just want to know. And then after, once I tell them and I ask them for the reasonable accommodations, I give them a very, very brief explanation of what sickle cell anemia is, so that they can kind of understand. It's obviously it's very brief. They're not going to grasp everything, but just so they can understand, this is how it can affect me. So one of the things that I ask for is not to be seating, not to have my seating underneath a vent, because normally offices are cold. Me, the cold temperature is a trigger. So that's just an example of an accommodation that I asked for, which is fairly reasonable.
It's very reasonable.
It's not anything. I'm not asking you to provide me with my own enclosed office by myself with the thermal heating. I don't ask for any of that. They don't have to legally accept anything. But if they do, it makes me feel a lot more at ease when I do start. Because now, at least and I don't go tell all of the staff. I don't tell all of my team. I literally only tell my manager and HR. Being in an HR position myself.
We love HR. What's good, HR? What's up, HR?
Being in an HR position myself as a recruiter gave me the tools and the steps to tweak the way that I would go about looking for jobs.
Oh my God, that's really good to know. There's a lot of like biases and misconception about people who have sickle cell anemia.
Yeah.
And one of them, and I'll tell you right now, that you guys are drug seeking.
Yeah. That is a big problem.
Big, big problem. And not just you guys, but also people who have addiction with drugs. They think that people who have addiction to drug, when they come to the ER, they're just seeking for that drug that they're addicted to.
Mm-hmm.
Or like those people who smokes, like severely smokes.
Mm-hmm.
Like you cannot just take away cigarette from them and expect that they're not going to have withdrawal syndromes or anything like that. Like you have to like slowly go from it. Like people wants to quit, or people doesn't want to go through this.
Yeah. So I had an experience, another story time.
Beautiful story time.
So I was in a situation, I was in a hospital, and I had a resident doctor who was hesitant to give me pain medicine.
Ooh, okay. That's one of the big questions too. Yeah.
Okay.
Go on.
So I understand there's a lot of debate. There's a big debate around this. So just to give you some perspective, people know drugs like codeine. They know fentanyl. They know morphine. They are familiar with these.
The opioids.
Yeah. Usually from addicts or popular media and stuff like that. And as soon as they hear the word fentanyl, they're like, ooh. It's like,
right. There's already
that drops in their stomach. They're like, ooh, like you. Ooh. So just to give you some perspective, I used to take codeine as a kid. And that I don't want to say I'm resistant, but you build up tolerance.
Yes. Yes.
To
it
these
does.
Things.
It is. So it is true.
If I was taking codeine at 8, it's not going to work when I'm 18. It's not going to be the same effect when I'm 28, when I'm 30, when I'm 50. So you expect me to take codeine at 8 years old and still take the same codeine when I'm 58? No.
That's not going to... Exactly. Like you said, you built resistance to it because the more you take it, the more your body gets used to it.
Exactly. So then you need something, either a higher dose or you need something stronger. So I used to take that. I used to take codeine as a child, as a minor. Then when I was an adolescent, I used to take morphine. Then as an adult, I started taking hydromorphone or Dilaudid. That's the pain medicine that they typically give here in our region. Different regions is different things. Some oxycodone.
And is that the one that works for you the best?
Yes. But just so you understand, every of these narcotics come with their own side effects.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, nobody wants to be on this, okay? Your organs get damaged every single time you're taking them.
Right.
But you're also, your organs are also getting damaged every time that you sickle, every time that you're in a pain crisis.
Right.
Think about it. There's a blockage in your vein. It's affecting that part of the region. And if you always have pain crises in that same part, your kidneys can get affected. Your bones can get affected. So it's like, you kind of got to opt out. Okay, am I just going to put my body through all this stress and pain, or am I going to try to just take the medication so that I can then target the other points of treatment that I need to get better? So people would rather you just tough it out in pain and suffer and compromise the rest of your body and your health. So the resident was hesitant, right? So they were like, okay, so we're going to give you morphine, for example, 1 milligram. I'm just like, well, I take another medication, not even morphine. It's stronger than morphine, and it's double the dose of what you're trying to give me. So just think about quick maths here. If I'm taking a medication at home that's stronger than the one that you're giving me and double the dose, why are you giving me something less and not even the equivalent dose? How is that going to help me? I came to the ER because I'm unable to control it with the pain medicine that I have at home and all the methods that I try to take at home. At home, I try heat therapy.
You do non-pharmacological things, things that doesn't work.
I try water, I try hydration, I try everything underneath the sun. The ER is the last resort.
Right.
Because I know it's long. I'm going to have to get pricked with needles. I'm going to have to do so many testing. I'm going to be nauseous off of medication. I'm going to be isolated by myself. You know, I have no family around. I'm in a hospital room. I might be here for days, weeks. Like, nobody knows how to do that. So that's your last point of resort. I'm going to have to miss work. Do I have enough vacation days? Is my house clean? Do I need to go grocery shopping? Like, do I have enough time for insurance? Like, you have all of these other things that come on your plate before you consider going to the ER. At least I do. Even if I say something as simple as driving to the ER, if I leave my car in the parking lot.
You pay that every single day. And that crap is not cheap.
It's not cheap.
It's not
exactly.
Cheap.
So I'm like, I have to think, I have to arrange for somebody to come get my car. Or do I take an Uber? Or do I take the bus? Or like...
So there's
think about
a lot.
I'm lugging a luggage with me because I'm prepared to stay. So I'm not coming with just a clothes on my back.
Exactly. So it's more like saying that, listen, we're not here because we just want the drug. We're here because we're actually in need of your help. And more than of the help that we've already given ourselves.
Exactly. So you've likely, as a sickle cell patient, you've taken steps to try and relieve your pain. For me, I use this pain scale, which I somewhat don't agree with, personally, my opinion, but I think it's a useful tool to communicate to other people. When you come to the hospital, most people, doctors, nurses, they'll ask you, what's your pain on 1 to 10?
Yeah, 0 to 10. 10. 0 being no pain at all and 10 being the worst pain.
There you go. You know this feel.
Ever. Where is your pain? Out of that scale, baby.
Exactly. And pain is qualitative. It's not quantitative. You can't quantify my pain because, like you said, you can't handle pain. I have a high tolerance of pain. So my 5 out of 10 might be your 8 out of 10.
Right.
Or vice versa.
That's so true.
So when I go, but it is, I've come to notice that it is a good point for me to communicate with my personal family. Actually, I was in a pain crisis last night.
Oh my God.
And today my ribs are hurting me.
Are you okay?
But you
are you okay? Are you,
you
okay?
Even know.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Okay. Because so we're at 0 to 3.
Exactly.
Okay.
I'm at a 0 to 3.
I love this. I'm learning so much from you.
Exactly.
Listen, I'm going to come back to working as a nurse, and I'm sorry, but tell me, are we at 0 to 3?
Exactly.
4 to 5?
Exactly.
What, 6 to 8?
Exactly. And that's how I kind of dial it in. So once I pass a 7, once I'm at 7, that's when you're just stay on alert because I might say, okay, I can handle this no more. It's been 3 days at 6.
Right.
or now maybe I have been able to bring it down, my pain, but now it just soared to like a 9 out of 10. I need to go to ER, because at this point no amount of home care is going to allow me to get over the hump and get better.
Right.
So I need the medicine, I need the hydration, I need the testing, I need to find out if I have an infection, I need to find out if there's something else going on.
Oh yeah, I remember too when you were hospitalized, I'm like running that normal saline at like 150 cc for I'm like girl, this is bolus, girl.
Yeah,
I'm bolusing you.
Yeah,
but that's really crazy for me. Before I come into your room, mm-hmm. I actually look at your past medical history so that I am aware of what are the medications you're taking before. Because most of the time when you come into the ER, they don't prescribe you. They prescribe you the medication you're taking in 2014. And you're like, wait a damn minute. It's 2023. Like, how are you guys pulling a file from 2014 and like 2014 and then considering that? That happens a lot in the ER.
Oh, wow.
Because there's no like sitting down in the ER and really going through things.
Mm-hmm. So they'll just randomly pull something and
they pull whatever is the most like recent and they use that because mm-hmm. they don't have any information from you unless they sit down with you, which a lot of time they don't really have the time to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So then there's no way. And so what I always do is I sit down and I try to I look at your notes. It's like, okay, what was given to this person? What was the last medication? Because if you tell me that you're taking 8 milligrams, I want to make sure that's actually what you were taking before when you went, the last time you went to the ER.
Yeah.
Because again, to back it up is that we just want to make sure that, because we cannot just agree with every single patient.
Yeah.
Because every single patient's...
Check the file.
Exactly. Check the file.
There.
It's right there.
I see a correlation and I feel like I have a better treatment from nurses that check the file first. Because if they don't and they ask me that, I usually ask them, did you read the file?
Right.
I usually will ask them and they'll be like, no, I had no time. I'll be like, well, if you would have read the file, you would know. But let me tell you. And then when I tell them and there's still some pushback, I'll be like, well, go back and read the file. You'll right. see what I just said. It'll back itself up.
And that's good. And I really highly advocate my patients anyway. I was like, you have to defend yourself, to yeah. protect yourself, and to advocate for yourself
yeah.
because you are the only one who knows and who feels what you feel right now.
Yeah.
None of us is in your shoes.
Yeah.
And if you just agree with whatever your medical professional tells you, nothing is going to happen.
Listen, I've been misdiagnosed and all types of stuff. And the only reason why I was able to get that a second opinion or whatever it may be is because I raised the red flag and I was like, are you sure? This is not typical of me. And that's only because I encourage anybody with any illness, but especially those with sickle cell, to kind of know your medical file inside and out. Like, know what your regular symptoms are, know what you're predisposed to, know your medicine, know your doctor's contact information as much as you can. The more you know, the better you're going to help yourself. Know what symptoms to look for, because of course the medical professionals are there to help you, but like
right.
just like you mentioned, they don't know what you're going through. They don't know what you may be predisposed to. They could make errors too. Like, they
right.
can make a mistake too. You know, there was one time where I got diagnosed with something that was so scary. It was so scary. And me and my whole family were, I was breaking down. I was like,
and do you mind sharing it? What?
Yeah. Okay. So for sickle cell patients, the number one cause of fatality is being diagnosed with acute chest syndrome.
Oh yes. Yeah. Acute chest syndrome.
So,
oh my God. Like, okay.
So to explain, it's basically a pain crisis somewhere in your chest. It's causing a blockage.
It's almost like a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. So acute chest syndrome is what I was diagnosed with. And I was freaking out. I was freaking out. I was like, oh my goodness. I knew that, okay, it doesn't necessarily mean that acute chest syndrome diagnosis equals death. No.
Right.
But
it's still like severe. It's like those severe cases and you're like, wait.
Yeah. And I was in the hospital for, that was the longest hospitalization I ever had in my life. I was in the hospital for a month.
Oh
and
my
I
Lord.
I didn't even go to the hospital necessarily for a sickle cell crisis. I went for an infection that I had in my throat. They were never able to 100% diagnose it. They were saying it was probably like something like laryngitis or bronchitis, something like that, but they couldn't pinpoint what it is.
Yes.
And then it was just wreaking havoc on my body. And then on top of that, causing a sickle cell crisis. And then on top of that, I got the acute chest syndrome diagnosis. And then there was a whole bunch of
You must be so stressed.
Then there was so much back and forth with the medical team on whether or not this was an accurate diagnosis. And I'm like, you guys can't be playing with my life like this. Is this a sickle cell pain crisis in my chest? Is it acute chest syndrome or not? Then they were saying, no, we have to do more testing. And other teams were saying yes. And then the residents were the ones who diagnosed me. Other doctors came back and said, no, we don't think this is what it is. It was stressful.
It is stressful for the patient. And I understand you I understand you so much because, again, there is sometimes a problem with communicating with medical professionals. Like, for some reason, nurses are their messengers.
Yeah.
They expect us to tell every single one of them what's going on with you, the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't communicate. So then you'll have four different groups of people coming into your room with different things.
Yes, yes.
And you're like, wait a damn minute. Somebody told me I have arthritis and now you're telling me I have acute chest syndrome?
Exactly.
I was like, didn't you guys spoke to each other and get this together?
So me, basically, I personally, as a patient, I want you to actually give me your opinion. I use my nurse as that central point. I'm like, okay, so this team said that. What does my file say? Okay, so this doctor said that. What does the file say?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm like, okay, go back to the file. What does it say in the paper? What does it say on paper?
And you know what? We are as pissed as you are.
Yeah.
You know why? Because we're not even supposed to tell you the diagnosis.
It's their responsibility.
It's this higher ups, doctors, residents, who should be telling you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is some of them, I'm not generalizing everyone, mm-hmm. some of them don't communicate with each other.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my experience.
And the funny thing is that all of their information is from the nurses. It's coming from us because we are the person 24/7 in bedside with you.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, we pass this information to them. And for some reason, they never pass it through.
Yeah.
The higher ups.
It just gets stuck there.
Right. And then they're like, oh, and then the surgeon or the big doctor comes in asking us, oh, why haven't I been told about this? Ask your people.
Mm-hmm.
Ask your residents.
Yeah.
We've told you. Mm-hmm. We're 6-7 different nurses who have passed through this shift and we all know what's going on.
Yeah.
How are you guys not aware of this?
Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying that every single resident or doctor is like that, but I think there should be a better communication between medical professionals before they come into a patient's room instead of just coming in with a paper they've had for the past five days ago mm-hmm. about the patients.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're really sick, so much can happen. So much can change in 24 hours. With from a patient's perspective, you can be feeling okay, getting a little bit better, but then something changes from overnight. And then the doctor is going based off your diagnosis or your test results that came in yesterday.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, did you know that I wasn't able to hold any food down for the last 18 hours?
Right. So and you're telling me my potassium, my sodium is low?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've been throwing up for the past, 12 hours?
Exactly.
That's why.
So that goes back to when I was hospitalized for that month. There was a period of time when I was in the hospital for that long, and I could not hold anything down. Everything that I tried to digest was coming right back up. So the doctor came in your hemoglobin's looking good and da-da-da. I'm like, well, they just drew my blood this morning at 5 a.m. So what is the new updated? What? Yeah. What's the what is the updated results?
And because for the past 8 hours, it's not like that.
Exactly. It's like, oh, okay, I'm going to have to check it. Then they check it and they come back the next day. And they're like, oh, so you're anemic again. You might need a blood transfusion. I'm like, yeah, that's mm-hmm. what I thought. Yeah.
And since you're talking about that blood transfusion, I know blood transfusion is something that benefits a lot of mm-hmm. sickle cell anemia patients
mm-hmm.
because then it helps restore the red blood cells mm-hmm. quicker than waiting for your like bone marrow to produce it.
Yes.
So what is the things that you guys struggle with when it comes to like blood transfusion?
Okay. So I'll talk from personal experience. So personally, I went majority of my life and I never received any blood. Right. I think I got my first blood transfusion maybe about 5-6 years ago. So thankfully in my case,
wow,
I went a long time without ever needing a blood transfusion. One time, again, I was really, really sick. I was in the hospital and things were looking shaky.
It's not good, babe.
Exactly. Things were looking shaky and everybody in my family was getting concerned. I was getting concerned because no matter what treatment we were doing, it just wasn't working. I was just declining. And they gave me a blood transfusion and me and everybody, we were all miseducated about blood transfusions. And
right.
I find a lot of people, unfortunately, from our community is just very hesitant when it comes to medical anything, like the medical community, and also from blood transfusion itself.
Right. Because again, there's a lot of, I guess, again, misconception.
Yeah.
Just in general with blood transfusion. Yeah. Like, oh, is this someone with like HIV or AIDS, or is this a blood that's gonna give me something else? Mm-hmm. There are many things that surrounds that, mm-hmm. but I think what people have to realize is that this, like, when people donate blood, it goes through process.
Exactly,
they don't just get approved.
It's not like from your vein to my vein. And
right. Yeah. They're not just going to take it from one person. It's like, oh, you are going to get this.
Yeah.
Like it goes through process and they eliminate things from it. Like they even do like questionnaires before you even get blood transfusion.
Exactly.
Because that's the proper way of doing it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, in the hospital too, we have to do, we have to take your blood, send it to the blood bank, make sure it's the right fit for you.
Yeah.
And before, like, there's so many processes before you even get this blood.
It's a very diligent, specific procedure. So like you were saying, okay, so they had drawn my blood, they decided my blood type, and even it goes beyond just blood type. There's so many other subcategories.
Phenotypes and all of those stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And something that I learned in recent years as well is that you have a better match with somebody from your own descendant makeup. So me as somebody coming from the Black community, there's a higher chance that I'll have a better match of matching all of those subcategories aside from just O positive, A positive, B positive.
Right.
From somebody from the same racial makeup as me versus getting somebody who may be like white or Asian or something like that.
Right.
So there's that. That's a beneficial factor, getting blood from someone of your own community. And then afterwards, people with sickle cell, who undergo regular blood transfusions or just anybody gets regular blood transfusion, you have the risk of developing iron overload.
Right. Because
your body has no way of dispensing iron. So you're just going to keep on building that up in your body. And then that causes other problems for other organs. So at the time when I was in the hospital, we were very naive. We were like, okay, is there a possibility of getting an infection from this blood? Where is it coming from? We didn't know how long we had to wait. So they had drawn my blood. They sent it off to the blood bank, decided what my hemoglobin was. It was very low. So for most people, their average blood count is like 120 or up.
Right.
For me,
it's also differs for like gender.
Yeah. So for me, now I'm on a specific medication that makes it a little bit higher. But then at the time, my regular blood count was like 80.
Oh my God.
70.
Yeah.
Normal.
That's bad. 70 is like, transfuse this lady.
People pass out. Okay. People pass out. That was my normal. So if I was in an anemic state for myself and my normal blood count was 80, I was probably at like a 50 then.
Oh my God.
Right?
Yeah.
So I was in desperate need of a blood transfusion and I had received it and it was the first time that they hooked me up and I saw the blood coming and I was like, oh my God, I'm getting someone else's blood.
Like, what is this?
Yeah, I was like, this is so weird. But you know what? After I got it, I felt
so much better.
I felt so much better. Like, I don't feel like the benefits immediately. I feel the next day. They say watch out for these, you know, symptoms, itching, this, that.
Right. Those are like, if you ever get like allergic to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Anaphylactic reaction.
Exactly. So I had no adverse event, thankfully. But in my case, at the time, I showed improvement for like 24 hours and then I went right back.
Oh my God.
So that's
that must be so frustrating. You're like, oh, what? 24 yeah, hours? That's exactly. It.
So when people say like, oh, you know, I'm anemic. My anemia and your anemia is not the same.
It's not the same, baby.
Your bone marrow does not produce enough blood for your body. My bone marrow does produce enough blood for my body, except for a good majority of them lose oxygen too quickly. So that's what puts me in an anemic state. And blood transfusions work for a lot of people because then they'll just bring up a regular hemoglobin and you're good. You're good to go. But for me, I could... 3 months later, I can drop right back down.
Right.
You know, so it's a constant balancing act. There's some people who receive phlebotomies and they always get like blood exchanges as a part of their regular care. I don't get that, but I'm considering it. But it's a real commitment because then think of somebody, it's not the exact same, but think of somebody who's on a dialysis program. Right. Like you have to be committed to the schedule to come. And
oh,
get
yeah. You have to come to the hospital. You have to go through all of this process. It's physically, mentally and emotionally tiring and mm-hmm. like exhausting.
Mm-hmm. And it's to your own benefit, but it's a commitment.
It is.
So and now what I do, I take a medication that it promotes my bone marrow to produce what we call fetal hemoglobin. So it's the fetal hemoglobin is the red blood cells that you get when you're a baby, and they're the most healthiest blood cells you'll ever have in your life. But they
girl,
die
you're educating me. My mind is like, I never know that.
Yeah. So I never knew it either. And my doctor, she kept on telling me about it all the time. Like, Do you want to take it? And the reason why I was really hesitant is because technically it's chemotherapy. It's chemotherapy in a pill.
Whew. Yeah.
It's a low dosage chemo, but I was just like, I guess I don't need chemotherapy, but
no, because the side effect of it,
yeah, there's
must
side effects.
Be crazy.
Yeah. Getting used to it, it takes you a couple of months or even a couple of years, depends. For me, it was not easy. It's not easy to say the least. I was throwing up. I had a lot of stomach aches. My skin discoloration, dryness. My hair was falling out.
Right.
It's so much stuff. It was a lot to get used to. But the it doesn't work for everybody. But the benefit is those fetal hemoglobins, it helps your bone marrow produce more of that. So you have healthier and more healthy red blood cells circulating than you had before.
So you're really in the dilemma of like, but it's good for me, but at the same time, this is all the things that I have to do to get to that. Like,
yeah, it can cause weight gain, this, that. Like, it takes a while, and it's also another commitment when you first start the drug because it's called hydroxyurea. The reason why is because they have to find the right dose for you. So it's the only FDA approved drug.
Hydroxyurea.
Hydria is another name that people
call
it.
Okay, that makes more sense. Yes, I've given it. Yeah. I've given it.
So they're looking into new therapies now, new medications now, but
right.
Some of the medications that are on the market, they're more like vitamins, if you want to say.
Like right. So they're not really like
yeah.
They're more of like supplemental to yeah. kind of like
yeah.
help your body, but you need more than that.
Exactly.
In like many other people's cases.
And they're fairly new. They haven't even been on the market for not even a decade. So they don't know the long-term effects. Like, how is this going to react to your body in 20 years from now?
Right.
You know, so versus Hydrea has that backing. It's been on the market forever. It was used at first for cancer, and then they realized that there's a benefit for sickle cell. So that's how it started becoming a drug prescribed for mm-hmm. sickle cell patients too. But you know, there's times where there's shortages and all that stuff too.
Yeah.
And you become dependent on it because it doesn't work for everybody. But when it does work for you, in my opinion, this is my selfish opinion, I feel like the pros outweigh the cons. Yes, there are cons, but the pros outweigh the cons.
Right. Oh my God. Listen, Kili, we could talk forever with this. And I love it though. Like, this conversation just like heats up my nursing student in me. And I love it because I get educated too as a healthcare worker. Mm-hmm. And I think people who's listening right now can be educated too about sickle cell patient. And it is very important because then, you know, listening to this as a healthcare worker gives you more clarity and understanding and patience and really that care that you need to be giving these patients once you encounter them in your, you know, in your profession. And I love it. I love it. I love it so much. I've learned so much from you. And this is such an amazing opportunity. And again, thank you so much for being here, because I know all of these people have learned so much from you.
I'm so excited. Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. But I'm more thankful that you're here and grateful that you're here. Before we end this, I just want to, like, for every other sickle cell patient right now who's mm-hmm. listening to this, what is something that you can give them as a takeaway? As someone who's been battling with it for...
my whole life. You're diagnosed. That is so inherited.
Right. But when did the flare-up started for you?
At 3 months. So it's literally been all I know. It's all I know.
Wow.
I don't know life without it. Ooh. I don't know life without frequently visiting the hospital, without, even if you're not sick, just you have...
It's like pain is like your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Like pain is there.
You learn to live with it. And you have a large... As you grow, the thing about sickle cell is that as you get older, you have more and more damage to your body. So then you start growing and expanding your medical team. So you don't only have a hematologist that follows you for your blood disorder. Now you have a respirologist. Now you have, you know, your family doctor as well. Now you also have a physiotherapist. Now you have a cardiologist. So
wow.
your life revolves around managing everyday life and your medical, your health. So everything coordinates around hospital visits, medication, booking an appointment. I need to get a refill. Oh, I have this appointment coming up. It's just
work, it's everything. Life, it's everything. Everything is like medical for you.
Yeah, my whole mm-hmm. life. It's like another job. It's like a job.
It's like a and it's a job that you cannot quit.
Yeah.
You're like stuck with it. Like this is your job.
This is a package deal. Like when you decide to be my friend, when you decide to be my employer, when you decide to be my partner. Before, I used to be really shy and shy away from it. But now, over the last couple of years, I've just been encouraged, thankfully, by some good friends of mine to just be an open book.
Right.
And to share. And that's how I started my platform, as I was looking for a community,
because
mm-hmm. I didn't really have one that much here. And I was able to find that online, but then it also opened me to opportunities here in my own hometown.
That's amazing.
Which was great to join a sickle cell board of Quebec. And it's crazy how just sharing your story and coming out and just being vulnerable and no longer shying away from your truth. It provides so much more peace of mind mm-hmm. because
I like the coming out though.
Yeah.
It's like your little cute, like coming out, like I'm living with this, you know, disease, and this is me, and this is part of me, and there's nothing for me to be, you know, embarrassed about it.
Yeah, exactly. Because now there's so much people who I grew up with who knew I was sick.
Mm-hmm.
They knew I had something, but I never shared with them. You know, they'll know, oh, she's in a hospital again. Oh, she's right. not here because she's not feeling well. Oh, she has a doctor's appointment. But they wouldn't know why or how to help me if mm-hmm. I was sick. Now, if you're on vacation with me, listen, you have a copy of my medical file. Like
okay. my eyes probably like, okay, wait a second. Did we pack enough things
yeah.
that if in case we're in Punta Cana and we're dancing our asses off in the beach and something happens, yeah. I'm ready.
I went to a friend of mine's birthday and yeah. she just pulled me aside and she's like, you feeling okay? You all right? I'm like, yeah, I'm good.
I'll be probably the annoying friend though, because, you know, if you have a nurse friend, they can... It doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Like, I would be, like, I care so much even out of, like
ingrained in you.
Like, it's you. It's mm-hmm. your personality. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it cannot be your whole personality. But I'm like, listen. I look at people and I'm like, I know, I've seen that before.
Yeah.
Or I know this.
There's so many people that tell me that I should have probably gone into something medical. Because I guess having sickle cell made me that go-to for my personal circle.
Right.
So if there's something that comes up like they don't even have to have sickle cell. They could have any other thing, diabetes, heart problem, hypertension, whatever it is. And they're calling me like, okay, so I'm going to take this new medication. You want to look it up for me? Or this happened or that happened. What's a regular blood pressure?
You're a nurse for your friend.
Yeah.
You are your own nurse.
They come to me. Do you have this and that? I'm like, yeah, I have Tylenol. Yeah, I have this. I have that. Oh, you need a wrap. You need something. You're like, whatever they need, I probably have it.
Oh, that is so, so cute. Yeah. So yeah, going back to my question, mm-hmm. for someone who's suffering with sickle cell, one of the warriors, what is something you would tell them right now?
Be your biggest advocate. Educate yourself. I've learned so much just by putting myself out there. Different experiences. Broaden your support system. What helps me? And I found that this really revolutionized how I'm cared for is by allowing those around me to feel empowered. So if I am surrounded by my parents or friends or siblings, they feel helpless watching their loved one in pain and they can't do anything about it, right? Mm-hmm. They can't change that. So if I know, okay, I have to get my bag packed. I know I need transportation to the hospital. I need something to eat or whatever the case is. I find points of communication like that pain scale. This is how I'm feeling. This is where I'm at. This is how you know where the severity is. Then it gives them some peace of mind to be able to check in with me to see, how are you feeling now? Are we at like a, is it all steam ahead? Are we going to the hospital? Are we not? And then once I'm there, what can they do to help? Okay, well, I'll tell them, okay, well, I don't like this hospital food. So can you please get me something to eat, you know, or whatever the case is. And when I go home, what are the things that I need help with? Well, I just made sure that I cleaned my house from head to toe before I came to the hospital. So I have no food in the fridge. Can you help me do groceries?
Oh, that's amazing. Like that. So basically educating those people that surrounds you about the things that they can support you.
Yeah, exactly. And even when it comes to my actual medical care, like let's say I'm in a full flare up, full crisis, mm-hmm. I talk about it with them before it happens. So because I've been in situations where I've never discussed what to do or what it's like when I'm in a crisis. They just know, okay, one, you get sick, you go to the hospital, but what do we do between now when you're starting feeling pain until you're there in the ER? So I kind of tell them, here are the procedures. Here's what I normally do for myself. If ever, God forbid, I've never been in that situation where I wasn't able to advocate for myself. But
right.
If ever I'm unable to, like I'm just too much physical pain or I pass out or whatever the case is, here's something that you can refer to. And these are the medications that I take. This is what I do at home for myself. This is what my family does. I'm going to share that information with you. So if we're on vacation or if we're just at home chilling or if we're out doing an activity and I feel ill, you're not ill prepared. You don't feel like, oh my God, call 911.
Like, you know? Helpless. Yeah. Or just like
exactly
anxious and like exactly. Panic.
Because I can only imagine if I was with someone that I care about and they break their leg, you're going to go into you're going to freak out.
Fire or flight.
Exactly.
You're like, oh, 9-1.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there's no time to think.
Exactly. So I just don't want them to freak out and to feel helpless. Mm-hmm. So I kind of help them help me. And then
that's amazing.
It just really changed the dynamic between me and my loved ones. And it helps me. It helps me at the end of the day. If I'm not feeling well or they see I'm feeling frustrated in the hospital, no one's listening to me. Well, they know what's missing. Okay, well, I know that typically she gets hydration and she hasn't gotten anything in the last 5 hours. Or I know that typically she gets this medication and you guys are neglecting this. Or I know that her hemoglobin is usually at this percent and now they just told her it's low and she needs a transfusion, but you guys are taking forever. So they know how to chime in and to help me advocate for myself.
That's amazing. Yeah. I love, 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 love that advice because I guess, again, like there are other people out there who probably don't know that they have sickle cell or they have the trait. Get tested. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And Kaylee, where can people reach out to you? Because as you mentioned, you have some social media platform where you really do advocate for sickle cell people like yourself and share your story and whatnot. Where can they reach you?
Yeah, so I started a platform on Instagram because I wanted to reach as many people as I can and have a community out there that I so desperately needed. So it's given me opportunities like this to be able to be here with you. You can find me at Sickle Cell Patient Care, all one word, on Instagram, on TikTok. There's also a link tree, a link that's in my Instagram profile where you can get access to any interviews that I've done, website that I've done, and then you can get some more information from there. But I'm mostly active on Instagram. So if you ever want to talk, have any questions for me, you can send me a DM. I respond to everyone most of the time.
That is so sweet.
Yeah.
That is so, so sweet. And again, like if you guys are ever needing to talk to someone, want to be educated about sickle cell, our best girl would be Keely. And again, thank you guys so, so much for listening to this episode. And I'm so happy because not only for you guys who's listening, but for me myself too, because I've learned so much things about sickle cell that I did not know before. And again, like I guess the sit downs helps not only me as a nurse, but other healthcare worker who's listening to this right now to be educated and to be able to take care, give that high quality care for people who's suffering from sickle cell anemia. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. And again, if you're listening to this right now, do me a huge favor. Make sure you download this episode and all other episodes. Make sure you follow us and turn on notification of our podcast on Spotify and Apple. And make sure that you give us a 5-star review on Apple and Spotify. Again, love you guys so much. Thank you for listening to us. I will see you next week. Mwah. Bye.
Bye.
Oh my God, that was amazing.
That was so great.
Did you love it?
I love it.